This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm conducting an oral history interview for the Vietnam Archives Oral History Project. Today is May 3rd, 2005, and I'm in Lubbock, Texas, at Texas Tech University, and I am in the Vietnam Archive interview room. And I'm talking today with Calixto Cabrera. And Calixto, you are in Durango, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, and it's about 2:45 Central Standard Time. And Calixto, why don't we start with some biographical information. Can you tell me about where you were born, when you were born, and a little bit about growing up?
Okay, I was born in Isabela, Puerto Rico, July 3rd, 1948.
Okay.
That's the where. We were a rather poor family, actually. I was born at home, and we had this thatched roof of whatever material they like to put up there.
Mm-hmm.
More than anything, it was banana leaves. They were big on banana leaves, banana tree leaves.
Right.
They're big. I was there till about 2 to 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
My mother moved to New York. I really don't know if she went there to meet my uncle, who was already there, or she went with my uncle. But I think she went to meet my uncle.
Mm-hmm.
I remember her leaving as a little kid, standing on the window and just crying, myself and my brother watching her drive away.
Wow.
I can kind of still see that image in my mind.
Wow.
I think within the year she sent for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then I grew up in New York, in the barrio, in the Bronx.
Okay. Wow.
Down, I'm trying to remember the name of that street. On St. Anne's Avenue, the new projects that were built there, and before the projects were built there, we were across the street, 37th Street, I think it was, in St. Anne's.
So you're like 3 years old, basically? Four?
That main neighborhood is where I finished growing up. I think I remember being in Manhattan somewhere.
Okay.
Downtown Manhattan for a year or two.
Okay.
And then I guess very shortly thereafter, I ended up at that particular corner that I was just describing.
Okay. What do you remember about Puerto Rico? I mean, you're only there just a couple of years, but what are your memories?
Well, I remember that, like I said, I remember vividly Mom getting into the car. Somebody was taking her to the airport. I remember her driving, the car driving around to the side of the house. My brother, who was 3 years older than I, and I both ran to the other window. We were both crying. We watched her. My mom was crying. And we just watched the car leave. And,
mm-hmm.
and that's the only memory of that particular thing.
Wow.
We lived close to a water canal.
Mm-hmm.
I remember running around through there. And I remember being afraid of the canal. It seemed like the canal was like way down there. But actually, I went and saw it as an adult. It was a little slope and small drop. But, you know, as a
mm-hmm.
child, I remember that being just huge, way down the mountain side.
Yeah.
I remember my uncle Louis Velez, and my brother were in the canal one time. The water was moving a little fast, but he kept coaxing me to come on in, and I did go in, and he did get me into the canal one time, and we played a little bit in the water. I remember this was a return visit. I must have been 16, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like when we got to Grandma's house, I rolled in the dirt because I was so happy to be back and blah, blah, blah. And they laughed. I also remember them catching my uncle,
uh-huh.
catching myself and this other little boy. We were throwing rocks inside. We had forced open the storm screening at the school.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, we were just throwing rocks inside the classroom. You know, we threw a bunch of rocks in there, and my uncle saw me and caught me,
uh-huh.
and this other boy. And I was really afraid of getting a whipping that night, but I knew that if I was asleep when Mom came home, she wouldn't wake me up to give me a spanking.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to sleep. I made sure I was asleep and she arrived home.
Good move.
Yeah, yeah. And then next day it was all okay. But those are, you know, those are, I remember the thatched hut being removed and taken and replaced because it needed replacement, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember all kinds of, we call them gongolongs, not quite a centipede, but very similar to a centipede.
Mm-hmm.
A whole bunch of them lived up there, and I'm going like, you know, and these were like 3/4 of a foot long, a foot long.
Wow.
And nasty looking things and all kinds of bugs and stuff like that. I was real unhappy to know that they lived above me.
Uh-huh.
And other than that, I kind of just remember I remember as a little boy, this must have been when I was 2.
Mm-hmm.
I happened to walk into the kitchen just as my grandmother broke the neck of this chicken.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, like, right then and there.
Yeah.
Just walked in. The chicken freaked out. It flew out of her arm.
Yeah.
And just started, and I just freaked. I remember screaming at the top of my lungs, turning around and running.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody ran me down and caught me and brought me back.
Mm-hmm.
That was very traumatizing for a little fellow.
Mm-hmm.
And another chicken event.
Mm-hmm.
Where I was outside and just this chicken with her chicks. I just got too close to either her or her chicks, and she started chasing me, just charged me, and I again just screamed and freaked out and started running. And I think it was my grandmother at the time caught up with me and kicked the chicken away, you know?
Yeah. Very, very traumatic experiences with the chickens.
Yeah, I know. My wife says that this is probably why I gnaw the bones of chickens now. It's like payback or something.
Well, I was going to ask you if you eat chicken now.
I eat the heck out of it.
Okay.
I've been paying back for a while. And I remember going into the cane field, myself and my brother, and we cut down a few pieces of sugar cane.
Mm-hmm.
Sometime later, the owner of the field, which was kind of like a friend of the family and had allowed my grandmother, I guess, to build her home on that piece, on that corner piece of the property.
Mm-hmm.
He was all pissed off and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I remember my grandmother standing up for us. And they just kind of, there was not good feelings between the two because of what had happened. But
yeah.
I also learned to leave the doggone cane alone and don't cut it down.
Right.
And I remember there being, the avocado tree was so big that avocados in Puerto Rico are not like avocados in the States unless you go to New York to buy them.
Mm-hmm.
Where in the state, avocados are these tiny little things, you know, a little bit. In Puerto Rico, they're the size of half a football, you know.
Wow.
Like that, just hefty, meaty, incredible thing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember throwing sticks at them and, you know, like spears to make believe I was a great hunter or something like that. And just left and right, just destroying these beautiful avocados.
Uh-huh.
So it was a fun little childhood. I don't remember going hungry over anything. I remember we'll talk about that. I was going to say I remember my birth. That was not a happy experience.
You remember your birth?
I remember my birth, yeah.
Wow. Do you want to talk about that now or later?
Well, I guess we can talk about it now.
Well, is it appropriate to talk about it later in a different context?
It may be from the perspective of, here's one of the things that I've been, one of the reasons I've wanted to do this interview was I'm sure that for me, this is not just about, you know, I went and killed some people and was traumatized, and those people tried to kill me and kill my friends, and I was traumatized again.
Of course.
We did all these horrible things and blah, 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 and I have all this guilt.
Mm-hmm.
I've been through that shit, been there, done that.
Mm-hmm.
As the interview progresses, the area that I want to get into is my healing.
Okay.
That I have come to. And the healing turn out to be of a metaphysical, spiritual nature.
Okay.
What excites me about this interview and the fact that it's going to be historical in context is that I want to leave a message to humanity that no matter what trauma that you've undergone, because I am no, I'm no avatar or something like that on the planet. I don't have any special powers. I'm just a guy who came here did some things he really regrets, resents, et cetera, et cetera, and was able to heal from it. And my message, my, you know, the legacy I want to leave is that no matter who you are, no matter what trauma you've undergone, there's a way to heal.
Okay.
If you want it, if you look for it, and if you desire it deeply.
Well, so, this, you'll certainly have that opportunity.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. So in that context, some of this, like the birth trauma and all this other stuff, probably are more appropriate to be discussed as versus like right this second.
Okay.
But I don't really care. However you want to set it up.
No, let's do that. Let's wait, and when you're ready to bring that in, then you do that, and that's fine. Well, how big a town was Isabella?
Don't know. I was too little to
know. Ah, okay.
I went back as an adult, and it's a fair-sized little town now. Yeah. I'd say maybe, 50,000 people or something like that. But way back when, it had to be just, you know, little tiny community. Little tiny. Small place. Of that, I'm sure. How small, I don't know.
Okay. So your memories, from what I'm understanding, of Puerto Rico were relatively positive, except for your mother leaving that one time. And, the other stuff we'll talk about later. So you're brought to New York City. That must have been just a giant leap for you, a big difference in what you see outside of your window every day.
Well, that's true. It was, I can't think of now as you, because you said that, I'm trying to think of, do I have any memories of, I can just vaguely see myself arriving at the airport and my mom, her arms open to receive us type of thing. Beyond that, I have no memories of arriving in New York, the apartment, what it was like. I remember I do have a memory that it was kind of like dark, the apartment, that is.
Okay.
Unlike the light that I was used to in Puerto Rico, walls and stuff like that. But that's really about it.
Okay. Well, what are your first memories there of New York City, besides the apartment being a bit dim?
Well, I remember that there was a little group of us that became friends, and there were three little girls involved in the group, and these were little white girls living in a pretty much Hispanic community. But we became friends with them, and I remember kind of like we'd all go feel each other up because we didn't know what we
were. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was all kind of so there was like an introduction to early sexuality. But I really didn't know what I was doing. I just knew something felt good. That's all I remember.
How old were you?
Oh, God. 5, 6, something like that.
Okay.
That I remember this particular kind of stuff.
Was this out on the streets or in people's apartments?
Yeah, out on the streets.
Okay.
Kind of like to find. And there was this back lot that was been pretty much abandoned. It had a lot of vegetation, so it was our forest and our war zone where we practiced how to, fighting multiple wars that we had way back when, and shoot 'em up, cowboys and Indians, and all that other stuff that kids do. But it's also, we built a fort, and it's where we'd go to that little fort back there, and, the girls would play with us, and we'd play with them, type of thing.
Okay. What else about New York?
The neighborhood, the block itself became our turf. And that was the same thing around the corner. The kids over there, it was their turf. And that kind of a mentality developed. And I remember that, we just had I remember walking around, I was around the corner from our neighborhood, and I was grabbed by all these kids. It was their turf. And just kind of like they wanted to beat me up because I was in their turf. And I was with a friend, and he ran away to get some help. And then all our guys showed up, and these guys ran away. And then we chased them, and cornered one of them, and I punched him in the stomach one time.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all little kids. You know, just little kids doing stupid stuff.
Mm-hmm. So, were you hanging with, what race ethnic group was this? Your crowd
when
of friends?
I was growing up, there were still Anglos living in the community. Not many. In either one. Either when I was living in that downtown in Manhattan place, or which was around somewhere around 52nd Street in Manhattan,
mm-hmm.
or when I was up on 137th Street in St. Anne's, there were you know, still a few Anglos around. Mostly it was Puerto Ricans and Blacks that lived in those communities. And thereafter, it was pretty much solely Ricans and Blacks. So,
did you all get along okay?
Not all the time. You know, there was a few gang fights between the two groups.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were living in the apartment portion of the street,
mm-hmm.
and that was pretty much all Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
And then across the street was the projects, and that was a combination of Hispanics and Blacks living there.
Mm-hmm.
But the Blacks in that community seemed to form, the young Blacks, the kids, seemed to form their own gangs. And even though there were, Puerto Rican kids living in the same building and stuff like that, they didn't seem to become part of those gangs, you know, so it wasn't an ethnic thing, at least for, of those two groups, mixed gang.
Mm-hmm.
And I say gang from the perspective of maybe the way, you know, society in general would look at it. We more considered it like, we didn't consider it a gang or anything. We just the guys in the hood, you know?
Right.
You just hung with them.
Right, your crowd.
Yeah, it was our crowd, period.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Calixto, can you tell me a little bit about your mother and your father?
My mother, Maria Velez, had a fourth grade education. My father, really, for all practical purposes, wasn't there. I mean, I just found out recently, they were married the first time that she had her first baby, which was my brother, Edward Cabrera.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a breakup or something or other. Then he came back a few years later. They got together again. Mom was pretty young. I think she had my brother at 16 and she had me at 19.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother did not like my father's name was Manuel Cabrera. And she never really liked him. She would speak to him. She would be courteous. But grandma's form of courtesy was to be a little caustic, as I came to find out
mm-hmm.
later on in life. So he was not in the picture, and I think, you know, when I actually came back wounded from Vietnam the first tour, I had seen him, met him two or three times as a kid, and you know, he'd come over for an hour or two, something like that. Anyway, he came over to the hospital to see me and brought me a sandwich. And that was about the extent of my interaction with him overall.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
How does that affect you overall?
Pretty few and far between. Well, you know, growing up, it didn't affect me at all, I
mm-hmm.
didn't think.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, it didn't affect me in a conscious way. Being a parent of two children now, my son Sage is 31 and my daughter Amber is 23,
mm-hmm.
I ended up being the father that I never had.
Right.
I wanted to be there for my children,
right.
And I was. And so we have a close relationship, and I can see, comparatively speaking now, from where I am now, that I missed out on a hell of a lot,
mm-hmm.
a heck of a lot. I wish he had been there for me,
mm-hmm.
but the fact was that he wasn't, and the closest thing to a father that I had was my uncle, Raul Velez, who, he was there for me,
mm-hmm.
But even he, you know, the men didn't really interact with the children much, do much with the children. That was like the woman's job kind of a thing. So to the degree that he was a man, he was at home, he interacted with us and he played with us and kidded around. That was the male influence that I had in my life. And, you know, I was close with Uncle Raul.
Mm-hmm.
I would have liked to have had a father, per se. And
right.
Then I had a stepfather that was in the picture for many, many years, but he really didn't care much for either myself or Eddie. He loved my younger brother, Tommy, which was his biological, and he was, I'm glad to say, a much better father to Tommy than he was to either one of us.
Mm-hmm.
So, for all practical purposes, I could say that I grew up without a father.
Okay.
Yes, I do miss that. As an adult, I wish I had not been.
Right. And your mother, I assume she worked and supported you all.
Yeah. She worked. She lived with my grandmother most of the time, and then mm-hmm. and then when she got married again to Johnny, then it was just John Gutierrez or Juan Gutierrez, actually, Juan Amador Gutierrez. I want all of these names to go down in there, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
Then the three of us lived together, and then Tommy came along, my younger brother.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandmother and Uncle Louis, which is my other uncle, lived together, and then Uncle Raul got married. He has the three kids.
Mm-hmm.
They're all a year apart. I'm the oldest, but, you know, we're all spaced a year apart, so.
Okay.
So there was really five of us. I grew up with my cousins also, were kind of like brothers.
So you're close to them, physically close to.
Yeah, both physically, yeah. Both physically and emotionally. We were all close.
Wow. Are you glad that your mother made that trek to New York and brought you along, or have you thought about what your life would have been like growing up in Puerto Rico?
I have thought of that to a certain extent. I've decided that I am glad it was, you know, I'm looking at it again through hindsight and an
mm-hmm.
adult perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I think had I stayed in Puerto Rico, it would not have been would have not been what my life journey was all about.
Okay.
I needed to go to New York and start developing my manhood at an early stage by learning the, you know, the hard lots of life on the street.
Right.
And to prepare me, to me the picture is more integrated now. Everything was just happenstance then.
Mm-hmm.
But it became part of my training to prepare me for Vietnam and other things that would come down the line.
Okay. So let's take a break for a moment.
Sure. Sure.
Okay. All right. Picking up where you left off, why don't you tell me about your brothers? Tell me about your older brother, Edwin.
Well, Eddie is the reason why I ended up joining the Marine Corps, at least ostensibly.
Uh-huh.
Like I said, I have a bigger view of life now.
Uh-huh.
But I would say... He quit high school. He was like the leader of our little gang in our neighborhood. He and I would, while we were close, we'd have fights all the time. I mean, literally fist fights.
Oh yeah.
And he quit high school at 17.
Mm-hmm.
Joined the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And came back in his dress blues, looking very sharp, I thought,
mm-hmm.
looking really cool. And he'd have all these stories about boot camp and what went on. And I was all impressed, bearing in mind that I was about 14 when
mm-hmm.
he was doing all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I, of course, wanted to emulate him. And I pretty much did. You know, he'd say, bro, don't join the Marine Corps, but we were down at the rifle range, dinging away, and man, I got this expert thing. You know, all of that sounded so cool to me.
Yeah.
You know, from the streets of the Bronx.
Yeah.
So it was real different, and in his uniform, he was picking up on girls, and hey, I knew it was me. I just knew it was me.
Uh-huh.
So he was the main catalyst toward my making a decision. I ended up doing the same thing. I quit high school at 17, and I joined the Marine Corps shortly thereafter as I could.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. What about Tommy, your other brother?
Tommy, I'm I think, 9 years older than Tommy. Tommy came along as a marriage to Johnny, you know, we were kids. I used to babysit him, and we just kind of like, he was just like my little brother. I just accepted him. He was cute. He was a pain in the ass, and I loved him, and I was protective of him, and sometimes he pissed me off, and I hated his little guts, and, you know, the whole gamut of feelings, you know, that you have towards your little brother type of thing. But I was very protective of him, and he was kind of like a quiet little kid, looked up to us, both Eddie and I, quite a bit. He has two other brothers that I know of from another marriage that Johnny had, and both he and Eddie and I met those other brothers a couple of two or three times, but none of us were close to the other brothers. To this day, he and I talk, and he says those guys were never really his. He never saw them as his brothers. It was always, you know, we were his brothers. But we all grew up together, so that kind of made sense.
Sure, right. What kind of work did your mother do?
Mom did a lot of seamstress work. I think she did some cleaning, but primarily she did seamstress work. I remember once or twice her coming home, you know, with a bloody hand because I guess the needle, the machines at that time weren't as safety oriented as they could have been. And they, you know, I view all of that now as sweatshops. She worked in those sweatshops, and you know, I think once or twice she got a needle through her finger.
Wow. Okay.
Not a good experience.
No, I can imagine.
But she worked, you know, she was a hardworking lady, and she took care of us and did the best that she could, is what I say for Mom. She got us where we are, and I love her a lot, and we're very close. And now, unfortunately, she has Parkinson's and possibly she's at some stage of Alzheimer's. So she's, you know, slowly but surely leaving us.
Right.
My brother's taking care of her. Tommy's taking care of her.
Okay.
That's kind of sad, but she was a hardworking woman, and she took care of us.
Calixto, tell me a little bit about going to school and what kind of education you received there in New York.
The education was not that great. Of course, I didn't know it at the time. There was a lot of kids in the school. I didn't study much when I came home. The few times that I did study, I understood it about as much as I did at the school. There was a bunch of kids in the classroom, so the teacher didn't really have a whole lot of time for one-on-one. More often than not, I especially in reading and writing, I was pretty bad. But in mathematics, I was great. I was just whipping along. I'd normally finish any assignments that we were given two or three, maybe even sometimes four pages ahead of the other kids, you know, 80s and 90s as my grade. And so it was, I really caught on to the math very quickly. But the reading and writing was not good. And I remember one incident where we were given an assignment to read 6 or 7 pages of some textbook or other that we have. I may have been in a 5th or 6th grade. And I remember going home, and bearing in mind that Mom has a 4th grade education, you know, I asked her to help me with this thing, with this reading, and so she did. And I read and read and read, and she kept, I think I read maybe 5 of the 7 or 8 pages or something like that we were assigned. And so the next day when the teacher asked us to go ahead and read would ask my hands and to read. Says, okay, page one, and I raised my hand, and she wouldn't hit me. And this went on page two, page three, page four. I kept being very enthusiastic because I'd read it, and I knew I was going to do at least a little better than not having read it. And page five, she never did pick me. So she asked for page six, somebody to volunteer. I didn't raise my hand, but she picked me. And I did miserably.
Oh.
And I just remember just my little self was crushed,
mm-hmm.
and embarrassed and all kinds of. I remember that to this day. It's one of those little traumas in life that a child brings forth into adulthood and remembers.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember that. And I was really embarrassed and ashamed and I decided that, and I don't even know if it's right or wrong, but I still suspect to a certain extent that for some reason that teacher did not want to pick me when I was volunteering.
Right.
She picked me when I did not volunteer, and I don't know why she did that. Because I was not necessarily one of the kids who volunteered normally for anything anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, right now, I take out one of the things that I do. I work with, a naturalist with Durango Nature Study. So we take out groups of, five or six graders, fourth graders, do a nature walk, and we talk about the plants and the animals and this and that. And I try to mix my combination of the kids with those who are real quiet and those who volunteer for everything, I try to blend it and mix them up and try and draw as much as I can out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to do it in a manner that will, if they don't know the answer, it won't be that embarrassing. I have little jokes and stuff like that to cover them up and make them easier,
mm-hmm.
blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And I don't know, I just keep thinking that I just know that this teacher picked me when she knew that I did not want to be picked anymore. I volunteered. You didn't pick me then. Don't pick me now.
Right.
And that's when she picked me. So it was one of the, I don't know why she did that, but she did.
It stayed with you, obviously.
It's all my life.
Wow. Okay, so you were good in math, but other subjects were more difficult.
English and writing more than anything else.
Yeah.
I would say history. Actually, I like history now, but
uh-huh.
Because there was so much reading and writing involved with history, I wasn't doing all that well with that item.
Right.
But, well, so I can't even say that I was necessarily a peace student. And there was no support mechanisms. There was no tutoring.
Mm-hmm.
School had nothing like that.
Mm-hmm.
My mom, with her limited education, could help me very little. My grandmother couldn't help me at all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I never asked Mom or my uncles what educational level they attained.
Mm-hmm.
I would assume that it's either similar to Mom, if at all.
Mm-hmm.
So they couldn't help me much either.
Yeah.
I guess. So no one in the family really could help. So I kind of just made do as best I could, and since school was really kind of an embarrassing playground, I had no problem leaving it as soon as I could, and I did. I was a high school dropout.
Really? So how soon did you get this inclination that you just wanted out of this?
It wasn't a conscious thought per se. It's the multitude of little things that go on a day-to-day basis,
mm-hmm.
In a child's life, where I see things now that children need a lot of positive reinforcement. That was not the environment of schooling that I had,
mm-hmm.
and I started. I didn't really start cutting classes till I was in my eighth or ninth. No, I think that I actually remember a couple of times. No, I think that when I was in the sixth grade, I remember taking the dollar that Mom used to, which I conned into giving me for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely, the school says I got to have it, blah, blah, blah. So
mm-hmm.
Mom conned into giving me this. suspicious look, but she started giving me a dollar a day to go to school for lunch. I'd buy myself something to eat for 50 cents, and the other 50 cents I'd go to the movies. I guess I started cutting school a lot younger in life than I had remembered until now.
Well, I guess there was no real teacher follow-up, anything like that?
No follow-ups.
Wow.
So,
okay.
It was tough at the school.
How so?
Well, a lot of bullies and, you know, a lot of bullies. Being tough was the thing to be. And we just made do. I remember my cousins coming to me. They had put up this little swing somewhere in some alley. And some other kids were on the swing, and somehow they had some words. So I was older than my cousins, so they came to me. Blah, 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 blah. So we're going back to school, and I look down at the spot where the swing is, and I may have had some words with the kids there or something. But, like, what was recognized at the time as the toughest kid in school, Stevie, was a friend of those kids who had been on the swing.
Mm-hmm.
So Stevie comes over and starts giving me a rash of shit.
Mm-hmm.
And basically I said, well, fuck this.
Mm-hmm.
Boom, we got into a, you know, into a
right.
fight. And I didn't think I'd ever be in a fight with the toughest kid at school, but there I was.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother, to this day, pisses me off. My brother shows up from I don't know where, grabs me in a bear hug, pulls me out, but Stevie keeps on swinging.
Wow.
So my hands are held down, and this jerk is pounding on me. And I was so much madder at my brother than I was Stevie, you know, because I was holding my own against Stevie.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, before, my brother was killed about 6-7 years ago in a motorcycle accident. One of the last conversations we had, I told him what an asshole he was for holding me while Stevie was
okay.
We had a good laugh about it.
Yeah. Have you forgiven him yet?
Oh, yeah. I forgive him.
Yeah.
I forgive him. But okay. I needed to let him know, you know, that he really pissed me off.
Yeah. So this was a school where you had to survive. You had to be tough.
Yeah.
Look out for your own.
Yeah, that's about it.
Okay. Did you work any while you were in school before you did drop out?
Nothing in school. I worked one summer. I think it was my last summer before I joined the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of the guys actually ended up getting a job at some little restaurant downtown, and I was cleaning the tables and stuff like that. And I was only there for a few days when something happened between one of the guys and management, and management fired us all because
of it.
So, so my job career lasted maybe a couple of weeks or so.
Okay.
And they're all, what the heck with it, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't like I was big into it. But we were, you know, big into getting in trouble, too. And, you know, that's just like I wasn't there. I wish I was at the time. Now I'm glad I wasn't. Mm-hmm. They broke into the Pepsi-Cola company and started driving the trucks around inside. And there was this stack of Pepsi-Cola bottles that was maybe 12, 14 feet high by 6-7 feet deep.
Wow.
It backed the truck into that thing.
Oh, wow.
And the cops came and, you know, kind of like asking questions, and I wasn't there that day.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another time they went to a party, and for some reason I would have to stay home. I'd have to be home by 8 o'clock, mom's rule, while my brother, who lived with my grandmother, had no curfew at all.
Mm-hmm.
He'd come home whenever, and I just hated that. You know, it was all embarrassing because around 7:30 or so, I'm on the street and I'm starting to sweat it, looking at my watch, and the guys were all talking and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knew I had to be home at 8 o'clock, and they were all kind of like sympathetic and supportive, but it was just so embarrassing. I'd have to come up with, I think I'm going to go home, and they go, oh, yeah, that's right, you have to be home. And it's like, no, I just want to go home, you know, that type of thing. And it was pretty embarrassing. So first chance I actually ended up having a kind of a lightweight fist fight with my stepdad, and I left. I said, the hell with it, I'm leaving. And I left. Well, of course, leaving meant I'm going across the street to live with Grandma.
Right.
Who has no curfew.
Uh-huh.
And that was the end of my curfews.
How old were you?
Maybe 15.
Okay.
I'm 15.
Did you stay over there at your grandmother's until you left?
Yeah, till I joined the Marine Corps.
Okay. Were you into sports at all?
Well, yes and no. A lot more no than yes.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, my brother and my cousin still to this day tell me that I was a flake at sports. And, you know, my comeback is, well, you guys never gave me a chance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how could I improve my talent if I never got a chance? They were big sports. I mean, they could tell you all the baseball teams and the basketball teams, all the players, their records, their this and that. In retrospect, I am not interested in sports at all. I am like zero interested in professional sports.
Mm-hmm.
I like the Olympics, but you know, don't talk to me about professional sports and
mm-hmm.
don't expect me to sit down and have a beer with you and watch professional sports.
Mm-hmm.
It's not happening.
Okay.
and I think that's the reason why, because I got so turned down so often, you know, and
yeah.
For sports, like the guys would choose. It was like this thing we do, one finger or two finger, odd and even thing. They choose, and I'd be the one standing there left at the end when everybody was picked. You know, it was just like so crushing to me and embarrassing
mm-hmm.
that I just said, forget it.
Okay.
So I made up with violence in the Marine Corps for my lack of sports abilities.
Yeah, we'll get to that definitely
yeah.
when we get there.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you another question about your childhood and your memories there in the Bronx. What about racism? Did you experience that or see discrimination of that sort growing up?
One time I personally experienced it. Racism from the perspective of we used to call the black niggers and they
mm-hmm.
used to call us bigs. We'd call the Italians wops. Those kinds of little names for each other existed. So that kind of racism was institutionalized in our community. Insofar as interacting with kids of other races, generally speaking, there was no problem. The problems would arise, would be a one-on-one kind of thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
like you're a jerk or something like that. It wasn't a racial thing.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes those things became racial when a bunch of guys from their side came and a bunch of guys from our side came. Then all of a sudden, it was not only whatever the problem was, it was like a racial thing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember very young, when I was still living down 52nd Street in Manhattan, I had met this little Jewish boy, and he actually lived across the alley from us, and our clothesline used to go to his window, so we shared a clothesline, so to speak, across the alley,
uh-huh.
and we'd send ourselves toys, you know, blah, 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 but then when we were on the street, and I was with the Puerto Rican kids, something happened one day, he was there, and they started calling him a dirty Jew, or this and that, and they started throwing rocks at him, and I joined in to my, you know, regret to this
mm-hmm.
day.
Mm-hmm.
I made sure that my rocks came nowhere near him, but it was just the whole act, and I'm sure that little kid felt very betrayed
mm-hmm.
because he and I used to play together.
Yeah,
you know, and I let myself get caught into this group racial consciousness thing, and so I participated in that, and you know, to this day, I'm sad about that.
Right.
And one day my brother and I, we were young, I'm not sure what age we were, but we went to this counter in this restaurant, and this lady next to us, we weren't paying attention at first, and all of a sudden we realized she was talking out loud, and she was talking about us, and she was, when I finally did cue in and listen to what she was saying, they go, oh, yeah, they even speak English and blah, blah, blah. So this other person who was also an Anglo that was sitting in the restaurant told us, come on over here, boys, and transfer over to this side. Just stay away from her, you know, that type of thing.
How'd that make you feel?
Well, I appreciated his coming in because he came to our defense, in essence. It's like, you know, come on over here, stay away from her. But it was also a message to her. They're on my side of our line now, so you stay the hell over there and leave them alone type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, I was very appreciative of that stranger, his kindness to this day.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the racial events that I experienced growing up. I don't remember any beyond that.
Okay. What do you remember about the 1950s in America? This is when these are your formative years growing up there.
Yeah. I remember when they brought television home for the first time.
Oh yeah.
And the very first show that I, needless to say, black and white. I don't remember when that was, but it was a black and white TV.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as they turned it on and it came on, it was a gunfight on the roof by, you know, police and, you know, this detective and this, you know, hood.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a gun battle on the roof. Beyond that, I kind of remember the whole Kennedy assassination thing because I think I was in the fifth or the sixth grade, and I remember people started saying, the president's been shot.
Mm-hmm.
And at first I was kind of a little cavalier about it because I didn't pay attention to presidential politics or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But then all of a sudden, you know, just people started crying everywhere.
Wow.
You know, and they were really upset. And so it kind of like, it wasn't until then that some form of magnitude developed for me about what had happened, but I still didn't understand what had happened. It was just like I knew something really wrong had happened. The president had been shot, and then they said, you know, later on he's dead. There was just a lot of grieving all around the streets,
mm-hmm.
just crying.
Mm-hmm. Wow, and this is something you definitely remember. Any other world or events that you remember before you got into the Corps? I mean, is it like Cuban Missile Crisis or anything about President Eisenhower?
Yeah, I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. I remember having to get under the table.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, in class, there was this drill and you'd get under the table. You know, I'm not sure what good that'd do against a nuke, but,
mm-hmm.
but that's what we practiced, getting under the table. And I just remember, I kind of remember the tension that people were edgy, but I didn't understand it either, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew that there was a problem with the Russians, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But prior to that, I don't think that anything politics resonated for me. Nothing made much sense politically.
Okay. Well, Calixto, tell me about your decision to drop out of high school. And it sounds like that was a long time coming, and you're following the footsteps of your older brother. What else was going on?
Yeah, to call it a decision, per se, is, you know, kind of implies that this was thought out. I can't really say that I did a whole lot of thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
I started to cut class,
mm-hmm.
And that became a little worse as time went on. I started taking more and more days off in school from the class. It's just kind of like developed into it. It was like, I'm not going, you know, at some point it was like, I knew I'm not going back.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember any cutoff saying, you know, do I still want to stay in school? No, I'm not. I'm quitting. It wasn't like that. It just evolved. Just evolved.
Yeah.
I was not interested in it. I was not very good at it.
Mm-hmm.
So what's to stay for it? Besides, I had no role models. Nobody that I knew went to college,
mm-hmm.
let alone stayed in high school, or rather, you know, vice versa. I had nobody ever assumed and talked to me about. I say that because when I, you know, with my own children, I kept telling them, you know, it was assumed that they were going to go to college,
mm-hmm.
assumed that they were going to do certain things, and both in my first marriage, with my son's mother, we were not married, and then with my daughter's mother, we were married.
Mm-hmm.
That was just the nature of the conversation. There was nothing else to consider.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any of that growing up. So on the contrary, it was just the opposite. Pretty much everybody dropped out of high school. I am not sure. My cousins, ironically enough, ended up staying in school. I don't know how they managed to do it because I left. They ended up staying in school, and two of them went to and finished college. The other one finished high school, joined the Air Force, and actually I met him in Vietnam. Vietnam when I was in Cam Ranh Bay when I was healing from my being shot up on my second tour.
Wow.
I spent a month in Cam Ranh Bay, and he was an Air Force cook, and he came up from Saigon to see me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, I had no role model or encouragement to
right.
finish high school. They kept. I remember also the teachers talking about the trades. The trades were really pushed on us a lot because I think that they assumed
mm-hmm.
that we really weren't going to stay in high school.
Hmm. Okay. And obviously, the Marine Corps, you said earlier, is because of your older brother.
Yeah, and the Marine Corps was because of my older brother. It sounded like an exciting lifestyle.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you have any regrets today about dropping out at that point?
Well, sure. You know, I wonder sometimes what I would have done with my life had I stayed in high school,
mm-hmm.
Finished high school, and gone to college. I mean, I ended up going to college after I got out of the Marine Corps.
Right.
I got an AA degree and went one semester into a four-year. Actually, I went to the university, Long Beach. Oops, sorry about that.
No problem.
But other than that, basically, I have an AA degree.
Okay. So that you're.
And I did get my GED while I was in the service.
Okay. So you dropped out at age 17?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, well, did you go right down and sign up for the Corps, or
pretty much.
Yeah?
Pretty much, yeah.
Do you remember the year?
Actually, you know what? Yeah, 65.
Okay. All right.
July 20th of 65 is when I left the boot camp.
Okay.
Yeah. So, actually, I did most of the paperwork before turning 17, but they wouldn't take me until I turned 17.
Right.
And, so I was off and running.
Wow. Was it exciting for you?
It was traumatizing.
Well, let me ask that question in a different context then.
Okay.
Was it exciting for you, including the knowledge, or did you have that knowledge, that there's a war going on? It just started. I mean, we just had ground troops on the ground in Vietnam in March of 65, so it's relatively new, but it had been in the news. I mean, are there thoughts about that at all, or are you just, okay, I'm going to the Corps?
Yeah, I was, I knew that Vietnam was on. I wanted to go.
Really?
Oh, yeah, I thought it was like the thing to do. If you're
uh-huh.
young, you're tough, you're a man, you go fight a war for your country,
right.
Go kill a bunch of commies, and
uh-huh.
That's that. It was just a given. It was just a given.
Okay.
So I volunteered, yeah.
Okay. Well, tell me about your initial experiences with the Marine Corps. I can only imagine. Did you go down to Paris Island?
Yeah, it was Paris Island.
Okay.
When I was taking the physical for my classification,
mm-hmm.
which I think ended up being A1 or something like that,
mm-hmm.
They were giving me the hearing test, and I didn't know what the ground rules for the hearing test were.
Mm-hmm.
He just said, okay, when you hear it, raise your hand or something like that. So I would wait till the thing is nice and loud, and I raise my hand. You know? So when it's done, he looks at the thing and says, do you have hearing problems or something?
Mm-hmm.
I go, no, I don't think so. He says, you according to this test, you're having a hard time. And I said, what was I supposed to do? He says, that's when he tells me, as soon as you hear it, I go, whoa, wait a minute. No, you didn't say that.
Mm-hmm.
I've been waiting for the little sound to get nice and loud, and then I'd raise my hand.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I want to do it again. So he gave me the hearing test again, and this time I would raise my hand the minute I heard the sound, and of course my hearing was fine.
Mm-hmm.
So I had an opportunity to walk, and it just didn't happen.
Okay. That's very interesting. It almost fell through there. What did your mother and your grandmother think about you going into the Marine Corps?
They were not happy about it. And I, you know, they didn't really. I don't remember any conversations about a war.
Mm-hmm.
I just know that Mom was not real happy with the idea. You know, I kept asking her to sign the papers for me, and she kept saying no. But I kept badgering her and stuff, and I could be really obnoxious. and eventually, she did sign the papers to allow me to go at 17, and they took me in. But she was not real happy with it. But at that time, my brother hadn't been sent overseas. I had been, you know, and I wasn't into it to be sent overseas.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it really gelled for her what was starting to transpire.
Mm-hmm.
She just knew that she had, you know, her son wanted to go into the service. If he's not he's not working and he's not in high school, then why not, you know?
Right.
Yeah, keep him off the streets.
Right.
Okay.
What did your brother tell you about it? Your older brother.
It was that same thing about, you know, bro, don't join the Marine Corps, but blah, 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 blah,
mm-hmm.
blah. And then he told me all these grand, you know, I went down with the guys and we went. He just made it sound like it was hard on the one hand, but there was all these cool things that went on. So I didn't really pay a whole heck of a lot of attention to the it's hard on the one hand kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
As it turned out, it was very hard on the one hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I didn't like it at all, boot camp that is.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't like it at all. Actually, I didn't like military life at all. Overall.
But, really?
Yeah, yeah.
But, well, tell me about your first days down at Parris Island.
Oh, it was, you know, get off, you know, the DIs came on to the bus and started yelling, get off, this thing that they do, they think they need to shout about everything.
Uh-huh.
And we got out and grabbed our packs, and the packs were heavy, and, you're falling to formation, and you're like, follow me, march, and, it was just... there was a lot of adrenaline, a lot of I don't know what's about to happen, a lot of shouting, a lot of having to stand at attention, and you know, just kind of doing all these things that I was just not familiar with. It was not comfortable,
mm-hmm.
And being barked orders from strangers, it didn't work for me.
Yeah, what did you do? How did you handle it?
Well, I did what everybody else did. I did what I was told. You know, I was
right.
17. I didn't know what was going on. These guys looked like they could kill me in, you know, in half a heartbeat.
Uh-huh.
So I just followed orders, did what I was told.
Okay.
But I knew that I had gotten myself in trouble.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you think you were going to make it through boot, or were you worried?
I was worried.
Yeah?
Yeah, I was worried whether I was going to make it through boot. As it turns out, I made it through boot pretty easy by comparison with some of the other guys. The whole physical thing was pretty easy for
mm-hmm.
me. And my IQ was higher than... Then, ironically, I don't even know that somehow a friend of mine got a hold of, or saw one of my records at the VA or something like that, had my IQ test in it, and what the hell was the numbers? The numbers were up there somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, above average something or other. I don't remember what the spectrum was now. But I remember his name was Bill Unger telling me, I didn't know you had an IQ like that, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
So it told me that, and he told me what it was, but I didn't have much reference for it.
Yeah.
But there was one guy who had an IQ of 70, and he was ridiculed constantly for it.
Wow.
In boot camp, just mm-hmm. constantly.
Mm-hmm.
So boot camp was a pretty negative experience for me overall. The DIs were brutal. Sergeant
mm-hmm.
Baines, Sergeant Caldwell, and Sergeant Martin.
You remember them?
Oh, yes, I remember them. Sergeant Martin was the senior drill instructor. Sergeant Baines was the oldest. Whenever he was in charge, because they'd rotate, you know, one day one would be there, the other one would be there. Sergeant Baines was the easiest on us, and, you know, we could get a lot away with a lot more with him.
Mm-hmm.
The other two were pretty brutal.
When you say brutal, what do you mean?
Well, in the manner that they worked us, they, you know, they would work us till we would literally drop. And there was a sadistic component. Sergeant Baines, Sergeant Martin, rather, would one time had people standing, had us all standing at attention. And one of the guys, I don't remember if he was what they call a fat body there, which was somebody who was somewhat overweight and wasn't keeping up with the physical rigor in the manner that the rest of us were. And there was this inter-platoon competition, an inter-company competition, and one of them was a PT test. And they would be afraid that this guy was going to really kind of like make the platoon lose. He would make this guy stand at attention. He would burn him with cigarettes.
Wow.
You know, just burn his skin with cigarettes. And he also had the, you know, kind of like, wasn't an explicit order, but it was like, if you guys want to rough this guy up to motivate him, do so. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, a bunch of the other guys did do, because the drill instructor sanctioned it. So this was, there was a couple of, we had a couple of fat bodies. I don't remember what their names were anymore, but they were treated pretty badly. Now that said, I was what they call the house mouse. There was usually two house mouse per platoon. They were the people who cleaned the drill instructor's gear and kept their shoes spit shined and stuff like that. So we got special little bennies that the rest of the platoon wouldn't get. And one of the bennies was, if we did a good job and we stayed up with all the other rigors that the platoon had to do, we were pretty much automatically got PFC out of boot camp, which I did. And I think each platoon got maybe two or three people that they gave the rank of PFC to.
How did you get that position?
I volunteered. I just raised my hand. When he asked for a couple of, you know, when they said, who wants to be a house now? They explained what it was.
Okay.
I said, you know, what the hell? Something in there told me that this would be, you know, a good job.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got picked. Luck of the draw, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Myself and this other guy. And in a sense, it was good for us because we got away with a bunch of shit that the rest of the platoon didn't because of it. But as a result, when we went to ITR, the Infantry Training Regiment, we were the senior people because we had rank.
Right.
Now, so which means that the equivalent of platoon commander and platoon sergeant were the PFCs that came out of boot camp.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a platoon sergeant, and one of the other guys was platoon commander. Well, and then guess what? The way we ran the platoon of these guys, we ended up doing some of the same stuff that the VIs did.
Right.
You know, and right. I remember that myself, and I don't remember who this other guy was, PFC. His name may come to me in a little bit.
Okay.
But we were as brutal as we could possibly be, including we made one of the guys stand at attention while we burned him with cigarettes.
Was it good motivation?
I don't know if it was a good motivator. The guy involved did try and keep up to the best. He was already at trying the best of his ability. So I'm not sure that the rest of that stuff just on our part was just maliciousness, stuff we'd learned from boot camp as to how you treat the troops, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm not sure that it was any more of a motivator than not burning him.
Right.
You know?
Okay.
That type of thing.
Okay.
And one of those other regrets that I have in life, type of thing.
Yeah.
But I did it. You know, that's that.
What was a typical day at Parris Island like for you?
You kind of get up, you know, they throw the trash can down the middle of the squad bay, or they take a trash can lid with a stick and they start banging on it, get up, you know, when it was reveille. And you jump up, I mean, you're just startled out of sleep, and you jump up, and you have to hang out the sheets. Pull the sheets out there to make sure that nobody's pissed in their sheets during the night. And then it was, you know, it was okay, and then start getting ready. And I think we had like a half hour to go to the bathroom, get our act together, get dressed, get our racks made, and get out in formation. We ran over to the mess hall almost invariably. Sometimes we marched more often than not. We ran. There was no talking in the mess hall. Get in, you get your food, you sit down, you eat, you get up, get out in formation. And then, you know, half the time we would, Sergeant Baines, like I was saying, I liked Sergeant Baines because he didn't like, when he was in charge, he didn't like to run after he ate because that's when they ate too.
Uh-huh.
But Martin and Caldwell, you know, they'd like to run us after we ate also. I don't know what they had to prove, but they, you know, they like to do that. So a lot of times we'd run after we ate. I mean, you get back and you just want to, for me, I just wanted to chuck it up
mm-hmm.
half the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then beyond that, it was calisthenics. The mornings differed, but basically it was the same thing. We'd either do calisthenics for a while and then come back, clean the squad bay, clean our weapons if we'd already been issued them, or we'd go to some classes on whatever, come back, have lunch, and go, you know, and then go out and take more classes, or we'll do afternoon calisthenics, or we'll go do a force march, or we'll do practice march out in the drill field where we would drill.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. All day, every day, same thing, more or less.
What about the weapons training?
Weapons training, since we'd already had the basics, we didn't do a lot of drilling and calisthenics. We did some marching. But we'd get up and we'd take different types of weapons training, and we'd take compass training, and then we'd go out and we'd practice assault, and we'd practice ambushing, and
mm-hmm.
we'd do a heck of a lot of force marches. I was a smoker, by the way. I started smoking when I was about 9 or 10, something like that.
9 or 10 years old?
Yeah.
Okay.
When I went into boot, when I was in ITR after boot camp,
mm-hmm.
We were, let me get my history straight here just to make sure.
Sure. Where were you, ITR?
ITR was in North Carolina.
Okay. At Bragg?
I don't know.
Or excuse me, at Lejeune?
Camp Lejeune, right.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know, like, it was just Camp Lejeune.
Okay.
Anyway, the reason I'm hesitating is because I don't remember if I stopped smoking there or whether I was in, after that when I got sent to California at Camp Pendleton getting ready to go overseas.
Mm-hmm.
It was either in California or at Camp Lejeune. All I know is I did, probably California because it was hills,
mm-hmm.
I remember. Did a forced march over a hill, came down to the other side, and I get down to the bottom of the hill. It was just like, I was just sucking wind,
mm-hmm.
as were a bunch of people. And we were given a break, and a bunch of them started lighting up, you know, and I lit up a cigarette, and it was just kind of like it dawned on me. It's like, wait a minute, what I need is air, not this crap. You know, so I kind of like dropped it right there,
mm-hmm.
and stomped on it, which my environmental self wouldn't do now,
mm-hmm.
you know, but stomped on it. I took my pack of cigarettes and gave it to somebody. I had 7 cartons in my sea bag when I got back to the squad bay,
mm-hmm.
and I took those all out and I passed them out, and that was it. I quit smoking.
Wow.
Wow. Like that. But,
did it help you?
Yeah.
I mean, physically, you know, get through the.
I don't know. I can't say because I was in pretty good physical shape. I don't know to what degree the quitting of the smoking helped or didn't, because I was already in pretty good doggone physical shape.
Right.
It does now, needless to say. And
mm-hmm.
God knows how many diseases I've avoided because of it. But,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't know that at the time. So anyway, quit that stuff. And ITR, there was, you know, a lot of running around and a lot of training with weapons users and tactics.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of tactics, we were taught, one of the things we were taught is how to lay an ambush. You know, you lay an ambush, you hide, you have plenty of camouflage, you stay there very still, you let the bugs eat you alive, but you don't move, all
mm-hmm.
this stuff, which, of course, we didn't do in the actual ambush side. You know, if a bug is eating you, and you'll whack at one,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things, crucial things that I think to this day they are not teaching, and I found this out. The difference between theoretical tactics and the reality of the field was that when you're in ambush, in an ambush position, especially at night, you're waiting for the enemy to come. Well, when we were in training, we knew what the enemy was. Mm-hmm. We knew it was usually a squad, or we knew it was usually a platoon that was coming by, and we were going to ambush them.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd step into the killing zone, and we'd open fire with our blanks, and blah, 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 and everybody, all this shooting went on. Well, when you're in a real ambush site, and the enemy does step in there, you don't know if you're dealing with 1, 10, or 4,000.
Mm-hmm.
There's just no way of knowing. You can't see them. And you don't know if you're opening up at the beginning of the column, at the heart of the column,
mm-hmm.
or at the end of the column. You don't know. And you don't know what you're confronting, and that component is rather scary.
Did they tell you this? I mean, were your instructors veterans of Southeast Asia? I mean, this is early on. This is still 65, right?
Yeah, no. None of my instructors that I can remember were combat veterans.
Okay.
But when we were in training, what they would say, just based on the inverse of that particular situation, if we're the ones that are being ambushed, they're saying if you're walking down, you know, blah, 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 and all of a sudden you step into an ambush, the elements of the squad or platoon that are not in the killing zone of that ambush,
mm-hmm.
you're supposed to all of a sudden begin a sweep and just start firing from the hip and moving in the direction of the ambush type of thing. More nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
But if I apply that to the enemy, you know, I'm thinking, well, I'm the ambusher.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's 100 behind this guy. I assume that they're going to reopen up an ambush, and they're going to go ahead and start, you know, just envelop us immediately,
right.
Start a sweep. That they're
right.
By the same tactics that we're being trained to do. And so, you know, I triggered an ambush on a bunch of occasions in Vietnam. Fortunately for us, they were always small. It turned out to be that they were a small amount, 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever it was. And if there were more than that, instead of attempting some kind of a maneuver and to begin a longer fight, they would run away type of thing,
mm-hmm.
which is real common for BC guerrilla tactics.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you fight and run and you live to fight another day, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
But I always was aware of the difference when my first ambush that was going to be triggered all of a sudden, and I was the senior man. It was just like, oh, fuck, how many people am I dealing with here?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. This is scary.
Yeah.
When do I start firing? How do I know when the last man has gone by? I don't know if that is the last man or not. There's all these questions. I just don't know. You just don't know because you can't see the column. You don't know how many people are coming, how many people are involved. And there were cases where, you know, an ambush would trigger and they ambushed too big a unit.
Sure.
You know, and they ended up taking a lot of casualties.
Yeah. So they didn't talk to you about this kind of thing. You had to find this out on your own once you got there.
Had to find this out on our own. I don't – yeah, I mean, maybe they do now. I don't mm-hmm. know. Maybe there's enough experience veterans. That were still in service,
right?
And we're putting training positions where they could actually talk about some of this kind of stuff. But none during while I was there. You know, I learned that one the hard way.
Tell me about other things you did at ITR. What other kind of training did you undergo? I mean, are they telling you, Calixto, that, you know, you guys are going to Vietnam? So
they're pretty much saying that.
Yeah.
You guys can just about count on you're all going. You know, because the war was heating up and cranking up, and they needed more and more troops over there. Now, we pretty much accepted that as a reality.
Yeah.
It was just basic infantry training. There was not much beyond that. I both learned to use, at the time, it was the M14 rifle,
mm-hmm.
Big, long, cumbersome, and heavy compared to the M16,
mm-hmm.
But accurate and tough as hell, you know. And the M60 machine gun.
Yeah.
We were never trained on bloopers that I remember of, so maybe we were. No, I think we were, actually. Not a lot of emphasis on the M79 grenade launchers, which they called bloopers at the time.
How were you on the weapons? Were you comfortable?
I was an expert marksman with the rifle. I was the thing I liked about the machine gun is that the amount of bullets going out was such that you could just move things and see the impact zone move. So you can swing the impact zone onto your target even if you're off.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So I liked the machine gun a lot. And so far as grenades were concerned, you just throw them. So there's no like accuracy or whatever. You try and get it. Tell you to hold on to a count of two or three and then chuck it because it's going to go off very shortly thereafter if you're worried about the enemy picking it up and throwing it back at you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want it to give them as short a period of time as possible.
Sure.
To pick it up and chuck it back. But nothing out of the ordinary. When we got back from Vietnam, I one of the things I did for a while was train officers. And which I enjoyed making them look like idiots in the field because I knew a lot of the tactics and they didn't. And I would do little tricky things that we would pull in Vietnam. They had no idea. They're boots.
Right.
Yeah, new guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And really, I enjoyed messing with their heads. But but beyond that, nothing unusual, no particular incident. The way that we adapted the drill instructor attitude towards our platoon I would say the only thing that really stands out, and the fact that I actually burned. So I mean, it's not like I took a cigarette and boom, put it on his skin. It was like I would bring it close enough where he would flinch and pull back, and then I'd yell at him to stand at attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like tormented him like that. You know, just like not anything I'm proud about.
Well, it's a long time ago, you know.
Yeah, it was. Memories stay.
Yeah, I know. What else can you say about your time at Camp Elysium? What was your personal attitude like? I mean, you are leading. Were you a good leader? Was your attitude good for that? Was this something natural for you?
I thought I was a good average Marine. I bought everything they put out. I performed well. You know, I performed both in boot camp and in ITR. I was at the top of my platoon. Insofar as performance, calisthenics, academics, these kinds of things. So overall, I was a top-notch Marine.
Mm-hmm.
I was good at. I learned well what I was taught, per the criteria that they use to determine, you know, if you're doing well in those cases.
Mm-hmm.
I did well.
Did that surprise you? Were you? I mean, you dropped out of high school. This is your first real. I mean, you went through many challenges growing up, but this is something where your older brother had succeeded and gone through. I mean, is this something surprising to you that you emerged as a good Marine?
I didn't think about it from that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not surprised because I really put my heart into it. I was afraid of failing. I mean, I had failed so many times in elementary and junior high school. So I really put my heart into it, and it was I was rewarded with the pat in the back kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
which I never got. And this is like something I'm putting together right now. I've never even thought about it.
Yeah.
I was rewarded with the pat in the back. That I never got while I was a child in school.
Right.
So no, I'm not surprised, but I was relieved
mm-hmm.
that I did well because I just I think the idea of not having made passed boot camp or passed ITR and gotten booted out of the Marine Corps would have been just way too crushing for my ego to take.
Yeah. The relationships that you formed during boot camp and at ITR, are you in touch with any of these people? Did you see any of them in Vietnam?
Al Kappa was one that he wasn't in my platoon, but I ran into him. We went down together, him and this other guy named Quinones. We all went into boot camp together, though we were not in the same platoon.
Okay.
Ran into them in different companies in ITR.
Mm-hmm.
And then we ended up being in the same area in Camp Lejeune after we finished the training there.
Mm-hmm.
We all went on leave more or less at the same time, so we went and saw each other. They all lived in the Bronx, and I lived in the Bronx, so we went out together a couple, two or three times.
Mm-hmm.
And then we all went, we were from Camp Lejeune, we went on a Mediterranean cruise for 6 months. Again, they were in other companies, but we were all sent on this Mediterranean cruise, and we floated around the Mediterranean for 6 months and practiced with other armies, you know, tactics, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And we all got orders for Vietnam together. We all went together. Da Nang was the last time I saw, I think, Quinones until I got back to the States. Kappa, I ran into a couple of two or three times in different places in Vietnam. And he ended up getting wounded. Quinones ended up getting wounded, and I ended up getting wounded. We all were sent back. I was healed by the time Quinones came back, and he was wounded, so I went and visited him in the hospital. And, you know, talked to him for a little bit. And Kappa, I saw when he'd gotten back, and he had healed, but I haven't seen him since then. So that would have been about 68 or so.
Okay.
And I have long since lost contact with him.
Have you ever tried to get back in touch with him?
Not really, no.
Would you like to?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Wouldn't mind having there. There's a bunch of people that I'd love to somehow see if I could track down.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the names, you know, I just don't remember anymore. I only remember guys in my unit in Vietnam because of my little diary that I kept, which I didn't put a lot of pages in, but I wrote down some names. And then I have some photos. I can see them there, and it's just like some of them I have no idea what their names were, but I wouldn't mind finding them. You know, I'd like to touch base and see how they are.
Okay. Calixto, will you comment on being a Marine? What is that like? And at this point, when you finish ITR and you're getting ready to go on that Mediterranean cruise, I mean, how do you feel then? What is the lore of the Marine Corps?
Well, one of the lures was that, right or wrong, it was viewed as whenever anybody talked about the Marine Corps, it was they're the best, they're the toughest, mm-hmm. they're the first ones in, you know, all of that resonated with me. And when I discussed the training that went on between some of us, and I'd be speaking to somebody who was in the Army or something like that, you know, it became clear to me that our training was rather more extensive than theirs was. But the thing that really stood out to me was almost invariably, since the president really doesn't need congressional authority to send the Marines in anywhere where they actually, at least those lines have been kind of become a little more nebulous now, but back then, the president didn't need any authority to send in the Marines,
mm-hmm.
where he did need an act of Congress to send in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
So the Marines were in their first type of thing. So that very macho allure, my own view of being a tough young man and not putting up with anybody's shit, it just all gelled really well together. Machismo and the military go well hand in hand.
Right, right.
So I had a very positive image of the Marine Corps and what being a Marine was all about.
Mm-hmm.
And that was then. Now, I have not so much a positive image about what being a Marine is about is what I call now the warrior spirit, and how it needs to express itself,
mm-hmm.
in a human life. And I embraced the warrior spirit early on in my life and didn't know it. I think I brought it in from past lives. In fact, I know I brought it in from past lives.
Mm-hmm.
And this, again, at some point in time, who I am now, both politically and spiritually are all merged. I am one person, but I have, because I have political consciousness and I have what I define as spiritual consciousness, I now look at a lot of these things and describe them from those perspectives. And so when I say, like, past lives, well, there's a lot of people that don't believe that. I don't really care, to be honest. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't.
Mm-hmm.
But when I talk about how I look upon these things, I can't help but incorporate that into the presentation that I'm making. So to me, I came into this life a warrior. I've been a warrior for many, many lifetimes.
Mm-hmm.
And as we progress in this thing, and we talk about my healing, that'll be very germane to that, because to me, and here's when I start getting a little emotional.
It's okay. It's okay.
To me, I came to heal, to enter this lifetime, to heal the need for being what I define now as a violent warrior,
mm-hmm.
or willing to heal that component of a spiritual warrior that needs to play out some kind of drama where I partake in violence and lots of it, both as the perpetrator and as the victim. And I think I've healed that in this lifetime. I think that whole Vietnam thing,
mm-hmm.
is the last war I will ever participate in. And in this lifetime or any lifetime to come, should I choose to be born again into a society where wars still exist, which I'm thinking real hard, that's not going to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
But as of right now, I heal from my necessity to fight battles, hunt down people, be hunted by people, and otherwise kill each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have killed and been killed so many damn times that I just don't even know what to say about it anymore. That obviously I needed to do that, but I'm done with it.
This awareness,
yeah.
it came to you later, post-Vietnam, I assume.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
But looking back, that Marine Corps warrior mentality, it fit perfectly into your evolution as a person,
yeah.
a spirit, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, okay. And perhaps, do you think that's why you were a good Marine, because of previous lifetimes experiences?
I think so. I think that I have honed in the whole battle process. See, the difference between my first tour and my second tour was that I got to be no more than a corporal while I was overseas in Vietnam, my first tour, which means that I commanded no more than a fire team, which is about four people,
mm-hmm.
3 to 4 people under my command at any given point of time. But all of us were under somebody else's command all the time,
mm-hmm.
type of thing. Where in my second tour it was unique in that as a Sergeant E5, because they took our company and split them up into what they call CUP units,
mm-hmm.
that combined unit pacification program, where they would blend one Marine squad with one platoon of PS, Popular Forces, which were basically local village militia,
mm-hmm.
For all practical purposes. I was in the unique position as a Sergeant E5, where at any point of time, I would have under my command anywhere from 9 to 50 people, and usually something that size, not the 9, but the 50 people,
mm-hmm.
you'd have to be at least a lieutenant, a second lieutenant, if not a first lieutenant, maybe even a captain, because some companies, you know, were 50 or less people,
mm-hmm.
type of thing. So as a Sergeant E5, you know, I was the senior man, I was calling the shots,
mm-hmm.
and I lost my train of thought. There was a reason why I was telling you that. that is based on the original question.
Was it you're talking about looking at your two tours and how you led and preparations for leading and the kind of Marine you made you were?
So the kind of Marine I was.
Yeah.
Kind of Marine I was. During my first tour, I could not play out as well as I could in my second tour because I was taking too many orders in my first tour. In the second tour, I was pretty much a freewheeler, and it was my own decisions, where to go, what to do. It was my own style of combat that came into play whenever we engaged, and those kinds of things. So in my second tour, I could tell how well a Marine I was or not compared to my first tour,
mm-hmm.
and I did a damn good job. I was good.
Yeah.
It was funny because I used to think of the local DC commander, who would be my counterpart, as somebody who I was in a chess game with,
mm-hmm.
where we were constantly moving the figures, trying to get each other into checkmate.
Mm-hmm.
And I got him in a whole lot of more trouble than he got me.
Mm-hmm.
While I was there, I inflicted a lot more casualties on him than he did me. And I killed a lot more of his people than he did mine. So, unfortunately, that's how I was able to gauge. Well, actually, that's not true, because another component that led me to the belief that for what I was doing and for what I have been trained, I did a really good job at it was when I went in R&R one time,
mm-hmm.
My second tour, and when I got back, the troops were really glad to see me. They were bitching about, I don't even remember who was in charge while I was gone, but they were bitching about him. They were talking about how stupid some of his tactics were, how relieved they were that I was back because I did know what I was doing. It was all very gratifying,
mm-hmm.
you know, to hear it from my own men.
Yeah, they needed you. They wanted you there.
Yeah, they needed me.
That's got to be a very good feeling.
Yeah, it was a great feeling.
Yeah.
Great feeling.
Calixto, you leave Camp Lejeune. You go on a med cruise. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah.
This was your first assignment, basically.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. What? Tell me about that. What were your duties? What did you do?
You mean apart from being when I was put in the on mess duty just prior to our leaving on this med cruise,
mm-hmm.
and it carried over onto the med cruise, the first few days of the med cruise, and
was that good or bad?
That was bad.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Be on mess duty ever, let alone on a med cruise.
Right.
It was not good news at all. I hated it. As a matter of fact, before we even left. You know, we have this stuff that they make in the mess hall we call shit on the shingles.
Uh-huh.
And it was ground beef, kind of like, I don't know, in some kind of a sauce, all white sauce mingled together. When you cook that stuff, it really burns like hell at the bottom. These pots used to be 3 feet tall, and I was just miserable. I was miserable. I had to wash these things all day long. And I decided but if you had an injury to your hand, you were not allowed to be on mess duty. So I was gonna cut my finger. I took my knife. I started breathing heavy. I took my finger and put it down. I put a very sharp knife to it. I kept going and breathing and working up my nerve. And then I just pulled about 1/100th of an inch when I pulled the knife. Felt the knife bite into my finger and went, ah, damn, shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said, no way in hell I can do this. I got to find another way out of this pot shack thing. Well, I never really did find another way out of it. I did my whole 30 days. And like I said, it went on to this med cruise. So, and the first 3 days we sailed into a storm.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I mean, we'd never been on ships. The Marines were sicker than dogs.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy guys were used to it,
mm-hmm.
you know, but it was like down, the barracks below, the whole place smelled of puke.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, it was so bad, people were so sick, that the fleet was brought back to shore until the storms were over.
Wow.
And then we took off again. But man, we were just sick as a dog, and the waves were high, and I had to do, I had a fire watch at the front of the ship, whatever the hell they call it, or whatever, at the front of the ship.
The bow?
The bow,
uh-huh.
where the thing crashes down and the waves come over, while I'm holding on for dear life, sweating that this waves don't wash me off. Nobody would ever know. It's pitch ass black. You mm-hmm. can't tell anything. it would take hours before they knew I was even missing. So I'm holding on for dear life, and I'm sick as a dog.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't tell you. I would have just preferred to be shot right at the spot and put out of my misery, because misery was where I was at.
Well,
so anyway, they took us back and kind of let us settle in for a few days. They took back out again, and then everything was a whole lot better. And it was routine, kind of same routine. You get up in the morning, you do calisthenics.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, you got up in the morning, make up your rack, blah, blah, blah. You went to breakfast. You came back. You worked your gear, cleaned your gear. You went up topside. You did calisthenics. You came back down. They couldn't work you forever because there's only so many things you can do on a ship.
Right.
So we read a lot and just kind of hung around. And then we hit these various, the Corfu, Greece, or let me see, it was Italy, Spain, Turkey, Greece. There was one other country that we went to. We do amphibious landings. There were several suicides on the ships.
Really?
Yeah, while we were there, one guy climbed, not necessarily on our ship, but, it came to us. The word would come back to us. One guy jumped off the ship. The fleet was stopped. They sent rescue boats to pick him up. Every time the rescue boat would get close, he would dive under.
Mm-hmm.
He just would not let himself be found, and eventually they lost him, and he was gone.
Wow.
Another guy climbed way the heck up on whatever you call those things on the big ships.
The mast?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Up there, and then, just jumped off and dove down to the deck, and he was crunched. I think there was a guy, they're not sure, they think he just fell overboard, and he disappeared, and they didn't find him. But it takes the ships like a quarter mile to stop and turn around.
Right.
It's just like, and it's virtually, in the waves, it's impossible to see somebody out there. And at night, forget it, you're toast, period. So if there's any hope, it's during the daytime.
Right.
So there were three or four, two suicides that I know of, but there was a couple of two or three other deaths. And one of the Marines, had heat stroke while we were on one of the maneuvers, and he was actually found by a villager, because we searched for him. There was a villager that took us to him, and they got him just in time, or else he would have been toast also.
Mm-hmm.
Dumped him in a vat of ice water. But he'd had a heat stroke out there.
Mm-hmm.
That was in Corfu, Greece. Basically, we just, mingled with the other armies and did our maneuvers and got back on ship, and then we'd go on leave. In Italy, I had my first sex almost.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it was like one of those, okay, I think it was $20, you get on, you got 5 minutes, you better get off or else you're going to get off, and that's what happened to me. I didn't get off, so she told me to get off. And it was like, oh, wow, my time is done. I was just getting started. And that was that. So it wasn't really my first, it was my first sexual experience, but I never really kind of like consummated, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Did on my second R&R, I actually bought a hooker, a car, and a driver for $100 for a week in the Philippines. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And a good deal. And she was a cutie and fun to be with. So mm-hmm. that worked out real well.
Yeah.
How
long was the cruise supposed to be?
6 months.
6 months.
Yeah, and that's what it was.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we came back from that, and then we got we were given 30 days leave, and we had our orders for Vietnam.
This is 66, 67?
This, let me see, July right? So that would be between ITR, I mean, boot camp and ITR and leave. That'd take us to the end of the year. So I would say that's probably early 67.
Okay, so the cruise was 66, 67?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that was 6 months, and then we got back, 30 days leave, and we had our orders for Vietnam.
Back to Lejeune?
Yeah, back to Lejeune.
Okay.
Yeah, we left from Norfolk, Virginia.
Okay.
And when we went on leave, we went with our orders. We weren't even going back to that unit. It was just like, you know, we're headed for Camp Pendleton.
Right. You got your orders, and the next place you would go would be shipping off to Vietnam.
Right, right. Well, we went. Actually, there was a training in Camp Pendleton, which I think is about 30 days,
mm-hmm.
Specific to jungle warfare, which, you know, there is no jungle
mm-hmm.
in Southern California.
Right.
And there may be some forest, but hardly mm-hmm. a jungle. But to the best they could, they have these little Vietnamese villages,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, they teach you to speak a tiny bit of Vietnamese, and you play village raids and stuff like that.
Hmm. Okay.
And then I was shipped out.
Okay. When you got your orders for Vietnam, how did you feel? What were your thoughts?
I was mixed. I was both excited and scared. The fear was the fear of the unknown. I didn't really know what I was going into and this and that. At the same time, I was kind of excited going to war. This is what men are all about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going off to fight for my country. I was pretty patriotic. I wanted mm-hmm. to kill commies. I wanted to be a war hero. So I was ready to go, but I was also a little apprehensive and scared.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Calixto, why don't we go ahead and stop for today?
Okay.